Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we're a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. When we talk about serious thinking, we try to encourage a intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We love the ecumenical creeds. We love the later confessions that come through the Protestant Reformation, and we love talking about all sorts of doctrinal matters that relate to it. That includes philosophy and history and theology, and we talk to all sorts of people, and it's a lot of fun. We encounter new ideas, new topics, and it's always a great learning experience. So if you're brand new to listening, buckle up. We talk to all sorts of people, and it's fun. In today's episode, I am thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Michael Gorman. So I've personally benefited a great deal from a lot of his work, including a lot of his journal essays, as well as the book we'll be talking about today on Thomistic metaphysics. So I am guessing a lot of our listeners will be very eager to hear about this, because I don't know, Michael, if you know this, but in Protestant circles today, there is a great deal of interest in Thomistic metaphysics. So this will be fun. So Michael, before we jump in, just tell me a little bit about yourself, and then why did you feel like there was a need to write this book?
Yeah. So my name is Michael Gorman, as mentioned, and I teach philosophy at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., where I've been since 1999. What I mostly focus on is metaphysics, although since that's the study of being, basically anything you want can be shoehorned in, or at least into metaphysics, or at least related to it. I'm very interested in comparing medieval thought and contemporary analytic thought. I think interesting things happen when you do that. This particular book, A Contemporary Introduction to Thomistic Metaphysics, grew out of a course, a sophomore level metaphysics course that I taught at Catholic year after year. At a certain point, I realized I had sort of my own way of working through the material. So that led me to write a book. And it's meant to be, to use a phrase that I wish that I had coined, analytic facing. So it's sort of a certain kind of Thomistic viewpoint, but it's in dialogue with analytic philosophy.
So there's a couple of prefatory topics that I would be interested in hearing. I mean, one of those, I mean, just maybe to set the table, when we say metaphysics, what are we talking about? And is that distinct from the term of something like ontology or ontological? Are those things synonymous?
Sometimes people use the words metaphysics and ontology as for a contrast. I don't, and I don't usually use the word ontology. I just say metaphysics. And I understand metaphysics to be, it's the study of the most basic level, the study of reality or of what is at its most basic level. Now, when you slide into a Christian context, you might want to refine that and say, actually, metaphysics is the study of created being at its most fundamental level, because God is so different from created being that he's not really part of the same subject. But I won't always mention that. I mean, it may come up later. But so it's the study of being, and it's maximally general and universal. So you could study a squirrel and think about it in its squirreliness. you can study rodents. That's more general now. You could study mammals. You could study vertebrates. And every time you make a move like that, it's getting more and more general. Well, if you go all the way up, you're just studying what it is to be at all. So that's what we do in metaphysics. We study what it is to be at all, what all the things, what's held in common by everything that exists, and what are the main subdivisions of being.
So one of the things I think you do at portions in this book is you show the, sort of the relevance for metaphysics for theology in general, but I think especially in a lot of Protestant circles, they might hear the terminology of metaphysics and think, what does that actually have to do with theology and biblical exegesis? What might you say is the value for understanding this to properly understand the Bible and more theological concepts in general?
Yes, well, I think that when you do theology, you are always, you end up engaging metaphysical questions, whether you want to or not. The only question is whether you're doing it in a sort of conscious, organized way, and you know, you've got a grip on what you're doing, or instead you're cruising along implicitly, relying on metaphysical views that you've picked up from other places. Now, one might say, you know, but that's all a human construct. Why don't we just get it out of the Bible? But funny thing about the Bible, the Bible presupposes that you already know stuff. So like the Bible tells you the apostles were fishing, but it doesn't tell you what a fish is. You have to already know that. It tells you that the Jews were led out of Egypt, but it doesn't tell you where Egypt is. So there's you have to bring knowledge with you in order to understand the Bible. So it sounds weird, but you actually can't get everything about the out of the Bible.
So I have a lot of questions about a lot of the book. We'll see how much we can get to, but I mean, maybe we just start with substance in general. So when we talk about what a substance is, what is that? A human person is a substance. Is my computer a substance? Yeah. How do we sort of categorize that?
Well, in a way that I think accords with the sort of Aristotelian and Thomistic tradition in metaphysics, I use substance as sort of the central topic or the central theme. So whatever exists, I would say, is either a substance or it's somehow related to substance. So a substance is the primary kind of being, and the other kinds are secondary kinds of being. They're real, but they're not quite in the center in the way that substance is. But what is substance? So I keep using that word. A substance is an individual, unified, independent thing. So it's an individual, like an individual horse, like Secretariat or something like that. It is unified. It's not a pile of things. So like, a soccer team, it exists, but it's not that. It's a bunch of individuals. It's not one individual. Finally, a substance is independent. So if you go back to Secretariat has a certain color. The color is a kind of reality, but it exists only in Secretariat. It sort of depends on Secretariat, where Secretariat is a kind of freestanding, independent individual. And so those are the three marks, again, of substance, right? It's unified, it's independent, and it's an individual.
So I was talking to, I think, a biologist, I feel like a year or two ago, and we had been reading Jason Eberle's book on human nature and like biotechnology. And he was just basically saying, like, none of this makes sense to me. Like, in my field, there's no such thing as like a substance in this respect. It's just a bunch of different sort of atoms or whatever it is. Why do some people think that today, that there aren't actual substances or real entities?
This person was a biologist, you said?
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny because in my world, a living organism is the best example of substance that there is. Of course, I guess you could try to be a biologist and not care about organisms. You could care about cells or biochemical processes and then think of substances as just cobbled together out of them. I think, first of all, if you did that, you would be treating the cells as the substances. That's the first point I want to make. You haven't gotten around substance. It's just that you've decided that the real substances are these microscopic things, and the things that we thought were substances turn out to be just aggregates of them. You've still got substances in your ontology. But I would push for more after having made that point. I think that what's the phrase? Middle-sized dry goods. The ontology where macroscopic objects that are familiar to us in our daily existence, that those have a kind of centrality. I think that's worth holding on to, partly out of just a trust that our normal human way of looking at things is reliable after all. But also, although this argument's a lot harder to make, I think that in a way you can't avoid thinking like this, although you can try. What I mean is that when you try to offer an alternative ontology or metaphysics, there I use the word ontology. When you try to offer an alternative metaphysics that doesn't keep these, you know, macroscopic substances, especially living ones, at the center. If you try to do that, you'll end up invoking the macroscopic ones anyway. So it's not easy to talk about cells without talking about the organisms. It's not easy to do science without taking other scientists as real unitary entities and not. If you treat your scientific colleagues as agglomerations of cells, you won't be able to have conversations with them. So I think in a way, this kind of approach to metaphysics has a sort of resiliency and maybe even an irreplaceability that strongly recommends it, I'll say.
Yeah, no, that's good. So one question I had that I forgot to ask, and it could be simple. So when you use Thomistic in metaphysics, how narrow of a set of views is required to be considered Thomistic?
Yeah, that's Thomists are always arguing with one another. And probably no one, well, no, I think I'm going to have to say no one agrees with Aquinas all the time, because Aquinas doesn't always agree with himself. He changes his mind on some things. Maybe he's also inconsistent unintentionally, but even apart from that, he sometimes just changes his mind. And you know, we're not going to agree with Aquinas about how the physical universe is constructed. There's some stuff that he's wrong on, and it's not all just stuff about chemistry and stuff. So there's a range. There's different schools of Thomism. Thomism is a place of agreement, but it's also a place of disagreement. You can have really interesting disagreements with people that you share a lot in common with, where if you totally disagree with someone, then it's hard to have any kind of conversation at all. But anyway, I tend to be pretty loosey-goosey about what counts as Thomism. I don't have a set of rules. But you could, you know, if you just talk with somebody for a while, you're like, this guy's more a Scotist, or this guy sounds like a Kantian to me. But, you know, calling the approach that I present Thomistic is more just a way of flagging to people roughly what they can expect. I don't feel like I'm under any obligation to agree with Aquinas on anything. It's not my fault that he usually ends up being right. I've stopped feeling guilty about agreeing with, I mean, it used to kind of annoy me. I feel like, why do I keep agreeing with this guy? What's wrong with me? And like, actually, I think it's just that he was right a lot. So it's not my fault.
Yeah, no, that's good. I can't help but remember I was talking to Tim Paul or something, and he was basically like, you don't have to agree with Thomas Aquinas, though he's pretty great and he's right most of the time. So you should probably take him seriously. And I think about myself, I'm like, am I a Thomist or not? Or is this, cause I like consider myself like Neo-Aristotelian. Like, I feel like I'm in this sort of family of views, but there are times where I'm like, well, that's interesting what Scotus said. Maybe that's a better way to cash something out. But I feel like it's so minor of a difference compared to the larger viewpoints that it's still in this bucket.
I think that's a very good way of thinking about it. I mean, you know, when you have, you know, one Thomist arguing with another, or, you know, with a Scotus, and meanwhile, people with wildly different philosophies are like taking over the world. Like, maybe we should direct some of the fire in a different direction.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not that I think of philosophy primarily in terms of shooting people, but I mean, I just,
so
it got carried away with the metaphor.
One area of metaphysics that I'm always very interested in and intrigued by is just the concept of change. So
yes.
When we talk about change, what exactly is change?
Yeah, change is tough. So the normal way of thinking about it is something like this. things are one way, and then later they're another way. And there's some, so there's a difference, but there's also continuity somehow or on some level. Now, there's a refinement that some that comes up in some of Aquinas's discussions. Sometimes he uses a word like motus, which flat-footedly gets translated motion, but I mean change is maybe a better translation. But he usually uses that to mean you, something is one way, and then and that way that it is gets replaced by another. So I stated that very abstractly. You have a fence, it's green, and you paint it red. So it used to be green, now it's red. But there's another kind of thing which you could call a change if you want, but you just have to be careful. Sometimes something gains a feature without losing one. There's no replacement. So let's say you don't know a certain, you know, Greek word, and then you learn it. Before you didn't like possess ignorance. You just didn't have anything, and then you now you have something. So that's a case where you don't have forms. I just used that word that I was trying to avoid using, but you know, you don't have features succeeding one another. You just gain a feature that you didn't have before. And if the opposite can happen too, right? You can just forget.
Mm-hmm. So I, when I think about change, I'm always thinking about especially concepts like the incarnation and related to God, because I think everybody, most Orthodox Christians want to say God is immutable. And yet we have the incarnation. And so how do we understand change in relation to something like that?
Yeah, good. So the way Aquinas handles this is he uses the same conceptual move that he earlier used to explain the relationships between God and creation generally, but and then he adds a twist. So the general move is this, because the problem arises before the incarnation. So so you want to say that, before God was not leading the Israelites out of Egypt, and then later he was. Sounds like God changed. You don't want to say that. Okay. So what you do is you say that when a change happens between creatures and God, the creatures change, but God stays the same. And the reason you can proceed in this fashion is because sometimes when something is true of, okay, let's say we have A and B, right? Sometimes when something's true of A, that's because of some feature that's really a part of A. So, you know, if you have a certain musician who's a good musician, that's because of the skills in that person. But if a certain musician is popular, then the popularity doesn't actually exist in the musician. The popularity exists in all those other people who like the musician. So when God changes, as we might put it, speaking casually, from not leading the Israelites out of Egypt to leading the Israelites out of Egypt, really what happens is the Israelites change. And Egypt changes and whatnot. Okay, so then when you go to the incarnation, what Aquinas says is that things change in the sense that a human nature comes to be, and it comes to be related to the second person of the Holy Trinity. So the second person of the Holy Trinity is just there in his immutability, but things are different on the created side. Now, this is different from the case of creation in the following fashion. When changes happen in the normal case, like if God's relations with me or with you, we remain distinct beings from God. Like you're you, God is God, I'm me, God is God. But in the case of the incarnation, when the nature comes to be, it comes to be joined in person Aquinas says it. It's part of the same person of the second person of the Trinity. So that way it's a unique case. But the sort of heart of your question was how you can have change, why the incarnation can happen with an immutable God. And it's because things change on the creaturely side, but not on the not on the divine side.
Okay. So I guess, I'm trying to think of the opponent here to say like, no, obviously there is some sort of real change going on. Is that because is the miscommunication there because we're using different understandings of change fundamentally for what somebody who wants to say, look, no, God obviously changes here. They're just understanding that concept in a different way. Or are they assuming a lot of metaphysical baggage in that term?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. In a way, you would have to, you'd need an actual interlocutor in front of you and go back and forth to figure out what they're really thinking. This way of thinking and talking is not just something made up to solve a theological problem. So you can say something like, let's say that there's a certain species of beetle that no human has ever seen. I mean, like literally no human. Okay. So it's undiscovered, right? It's not just like undiscovered by Westerners, the way they say like such and such an island was discovered and there's all this already people on it. Right. I mean, really no one has ever seen it. Okay. So it's an undiscovered beetle and then it gets discovered. Now the people who discover it change, but the beetle itself, it's just what it was before, right? It doesn't change, but we stop calling it an undiscovered beetle and we start calling it, I don't know, a discovered beetle, right? It's a recorded beetle. So we use language like that. It's fine. But if you stop and think it through, you realize nothing happened to the beetle.
Yeah. So I guess the example that I hear oftentimes with this is, well, you know, God, before he created the world, and then after he created the world, must have added some sort of feature. Now he's called the creator. Or prior to redeeming people, he hadn't redeemed people. Then after he did that, then he's adequately called this. Is that a relevantly similar contrast to the beetle?
I mean, it is. This is a very, very difficult topic. Look, I think I'm pausing and hemming hawing here a little bit because I'm starting to wonder whether we're approaching a sort of zone that's always important to be aware of when talking theology, and yet it's also dangerous. So this is the part where you start to say, well, God's very different. God's hard to understand. God's a mystery. Now, on the one hand, I think that there has to be a space for thinking and saying something like that. If God is anything like what Christians claim God is, then it's just, of course, going to be the case that humans can't understand everything about God. Like that's almost like a feature rather than a bug, right? Because if I said God is like this and then said, oh, and by the way, I'll tell you everything can possibly know, then that's not actually plausible. On the other hand, it has to be admitted that, you know, in theological conversations, people sometimes, you know, play the mystery card and they play it way too soon. And they basically just mean, don't hassle me. I have no idea. And so it's a mystery. It would be better for them to just say, I don't know, you got me. I'm stumped. Okay. But I do think that we're getting towards there. So here's what I mean. All those are these thoughts, right? Like God wasn't creating us and then he was. Surely that makes a difference to God. God wasn't saving us, then he was. Surely that makes, right? Now, on the other hand, you've got all these arguments which point in the same direction that God is unchangeable. Now, if you have both of those, something's got to give. And if you think that the arguments for God's unchangeability are super powerful and the stronger arguments, then you might say, look, so we need another way to think about this. And I'm going to do the best I can. And is it a little bit unsatisfying because it makes it seem a little bit weird that God is somehow, it's It used to be true that God wasn't creating. Now it's true that God is creating, and yet somehow God stayed the same. Does that sound weird? I mean, I think it's fine to say, yeah, that sounds pretty weird. But if the alternative is giving up divine immutability, so many things are going to fall apart at that point.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. So there's a couple other pieces I want to make sure to cover. And one of those is just like, when we talk about parts in metaphysics,
yes,
what exactly were we talking about? What kinds of parts are there?
Oh, yeah. This is a really, really hard question. And it's partly hard because the way we use the word part is very, you know, it's very multiform. It's very polymorphic. We just use it in lots of ways. So I think the two most important kinds of parts that come up in metaphysics, we could call them physical parts and metaphysical parts. You can, you know, ask whether that's the best terminology, but it's kind of semi-standard, so I'm just going to go with it. Physical parts are like the hands and feet of a human being, the legs of a horse. Or another way to think of what might be a physical part, the molecules or atoms that a horse is made up of, or something like that. So those would count as physical parts. They take up space. They're physical in a sort of common sense meaning of that. But there's another way to sort of divide up beings. And that would be into their features. So you could take a horse and say the horse is brown. So it has brownness. That's one part of the horse, its color. And another part is its weight. Another part is its agility. Another part is its jittery temper, all of its sort of personality traits. So all of those things are, in a sense, partial ways of thinking about what the horse is. But they're not just ways of thinking that we impose. They're ways that, in part, the horse is. So you can think of them as kind of like parts. But they're not physical in any straightforward way, so we can call them metaphysical parts. And there's interesting and difficult questions in metaphysics about how to think about both kinds of parts.
So thinking about human persons, for example, yeah. Distinction between body and soul, are those two things parts in any sense?
Yes, I think so. In any sense is helpful, right? Because it gives you wiggle room and you have to think about it. Maybe I'm going to be not getting the point of your question, but body and soul is an interesting kind of part because they are parts that are made for one another. They sort of belong together by nature. And you know, in the sort of Aristotelian tradition, a body without a soul, it's not really a body. I mean, we call a dead body a body, and that's fine. But its being a body is actually dependent on its being ensouled or animated. I mean, animated is just Latin for ensouled, but we use the word animated to mean lively, right? Alive. And then likewise, you know, it's really the soul belongs together with the body. So that's kind of a cagey way of putting it. It's super interesting. If you look at Aristotle's little work on the soul, he starts off by saying that the soul, when the soul does its thing, it's always an actualization of the body. So, for example, when you're angry, he says, okay, so this part isn't strictly accurate, right? That the blood around your heart is boiling. Well, okay, that turns out to be wrong. But like there's a physical, it's not just a manifestation of anger, it's a physical actualization. But then he keeps saying, except maybe for the reasoning part of the soul, that might be a different case. And then he sort of like talks about it in book 3 of the De Anima, the book on the soul. And that spawned just legions of commentary. Well, Aquinas is like very clear. He says the human soul, unlike, say, a dog soul, can exist apart from the body. But that's not the condition it's meant to be in. And things are better when the soul gets back together with the body. which is exactly what Christianity teaches. From Aquinas' point of view, this makes total sense.
So when I think of the divine, when I think of God, and we want to say that God is simple and has no parts, is when we say that, is that following how we've defined parts here? Or are we defining parts in unique ways when it relates to God? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. So a human being, say, has different powers, like the power of reason, the power of will. Maybe we should subdivide those into subparts, maybe not. But in God, all the parts are just the same as each other. There's just God. So the word for the technical word for this is that God is simple, right? Not in the sense of easy peasy, but in the sense of not complex. So he doesn't have, when we think about God, we inevitably, unavoidably speak as if God has parts. We talk about God's will, and then we talk about God's intelligence, and we can even say things like, you know, God's will is always in accord with his wisdom. It makes it sound like two things coming together. But in sober fact, although this strains human language to the breaking point, there are good reasons to think that that's the wrong way to think about it. Actually, all of those things are just one thing, and that one thing is God himself. So if that's right, then God has no parts.
So another topic in the book is on universals, and I'd love to spend a little bit of time on this, just because when I talk to a lot of people, it seems like you've got these very broad, extreme categories of you're either a realist or a nominalist. And if you're a nominalist, you're like Occam. And if you're a realist, then, you know, you're in this huge bucket, which apparently everybody's in. But then you read somebody like Jeff Brouwer, and it seems like he says, well, no, Thomas is a nominalist. And that would be shocking to, I think, a lot of people who aren't like super into the metaphysical weeds. So maybe help me understand these terms and these debates a little bit.
Well, now you're making me want to double check my Jeff Brouwer, because I think of him as holding Aquinas as being more on the realist side.
I do too.
Than I do.
Yeah, no, I think.
But
so
he
too.
Said that.
I now I've got to go check it too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I like Jeff Brouwer. Okay. So yeah, the words realism and nominalism don't always get used in the same way by everybody who's talking about this. Also, the way in which they get used sort of in the medieval period and by people who are hewing closely to the terminology of the period tends to be different from the way analytic philosophers use the word, especially the word nominalism. And so it's very tricky to avoid misunderstandings that are just confusions of terminology. So in the book, I distinguish four main camps, right? One of them I call extreme realism or Platonic realism. In this sort of case, being extreme isn't necessarily bad. It's not meant as an insult. This view says that things like horseness, the nature of being a horse, equinity, if you want to say it in Latin, it's like a thing itself. It's like a being. Horseness exists apart from all horses in a kind of Platonic heaven, as people say. Now, and then a more moderate kind of realism says that horseness is real, but it only exists in individual horses. So there's a difference between individual horses and horseness. Horseness is a kind of extra level of reality, but it doesn't exist on its own in Platonic heaven. Okay. Now, the nominalist camp, the way I present it is those are the people who say that horseness doesn't exist. But there's two versions of this. The first kind I call extreme nominalism, or I also call it Dr. Seuss nominalism, because of that scene that page in Dr. Seuss where it says, "Not one of them is like another. Don't ask me why. Go ask your mother." Okay. So I just picked up on that little phrase, right? Not one of them is like another. So this is the idea that everything that exists is utterly distinct and different from everything else in every respect. And this view, I think, is a crazy view. Like that it cannot possibly be right. Okay. So that's a view that maybe some people hold, but that's, I'm not interested in that view really. I mean, I talk about it a little bit, but like, I'm interested in the view that I think is most exciting to talk about here, and the one where I think probably Aquinas belongs, is that you can have like two horses, and each of them is a horse, and they are alike in being horses, but the horseness, the horse nature, the equinity, that's not like an extra level. Just the first horse, Secretariat, has whatever it takes to be a horse. And the second horse, what's another horse? Seabiscuit. Is that a horse? I think that's a horse. Seabiscuit has everything it takes to be a horse. And then they just match. They just match. And you don't need like an extra thing that's kind of pulling them together or mediating them or anything like that. So I would call that a kind of moderate nominalist position. Now, if you tell most medieval scholars, well, if you tell a lot of medieval scholars that Aquinas holds a nominalist position, they'll freak out. Why? Because they think you're talking about Dr. Seuss nominalism. And in fact, you know, like the word nominalism comes from the idea that the natures shared by things are just names, nomina. That's why where we get the name nominalism. So I'm not saying that, and maybe it's a mistake to call Aquinas a nominalist in this way, but I do think he doesn't believe that common natures have any reality apart from the way they exist as instantiated in individuals. But it's a very difficult problem.
If I recall, I think that's what Brouwer argues too. At least when it comes to Thomas. So there's a couple other things, and I'm going to be cognizant of time. So one of the pieces that seems important throughout your book is just the analogy of being. And so I'd love just to know, like, when we talk about the analogy of being, what is that, and why do you think it's so important for thinking about Thomistic metaphysics in general?
Yeah. So sometimes people distinguish, I find this helpful, between two kinds of analogy, and you can call them horizontal analogy and vertical analogy. So horizontal analogy. So what is analogy? Analogy means the same word is being used in different but related senses. So if I say I'm human and you're human, if you were to say, well, I mean, I'm human, but you're human in what sense? I'd be like, well, hold on, in the same sense, right? We're just human in the same sense. Now, you could talk about a riverbank and a bank where you store your money. Those two senses have nothing to do with one another. It's just a coincidence that we talk that way. It doesn't mean anything. Okay, but then you can say that a dog is healthy and dog food is healthy. But we're not saying that the dog food has like good blood pressure and its temperature is in the right range, right? We call it healthy, but we mean healthy in some other sense. In this case, we mean promoting of health. Okay, so the idea of the analogy of being is that, so horizontal analogy of being talks about different kinds of being on the level of creation. So that's why horizontal, right? It's just like spread out on the level of creation. So there are substances, that's the primary sense of being. And then all the different features of substances, their qualities, their quantities, their relations, all those things, they're beings too, but in a different sense. And depending on who you are and how you're thinking about it, you might go a little farther, right? Maybe processes are kind of, sort of beings. Again, but now remember what I said at the outset, substance is the central kind, right? So processes have to have some relation to substances, accidents, features have to have some relationship to substances like that. So that would be horizontal analogy. And that's just to get you to see that the created world has lots, it doesn't just have different beings, it has different kinds of beings and deeply different kinds, much, much deeper difference, like the difference between a dog and a cat, or even a dog and a beetle. But now vertical analogy is the difference between the way we talk about creatures and the way we talk about God. So it's vertical because like God is up, right? So we say that humans are intelligent and we say that God is intelligent, but it's not just like that God is intelligent just like us. And it's not that God is intelligent like us, but better. It's not like he can do what we do, but he's faster and he never forgets and he doesn't get confused and have to say, wait, let me back up and start over. It's not like that at all, right? God knows everything there is to know all at once in one great big thought. That's so different from our kind of intelligence. So the language we use about God and the language we use about creatures, they're similar, but they're also different. And that's why they're analogous.
So when it comes to the similarity, you know, is there some level of like, we are talking about the same thing at this, even if it's a really small core, let's say, you know, if I want to say that God is loving and I'm loving, there is some like intentional willing of the good that we can say, yeah, that's what we're talking about here. There's a bunch of different entailments and a bunch of different aspects that are completely different, but we are at least having some relative sameness in this conversation to be able to have an analogy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's basically right. So there has to be some kind of commonality of content. Now, one way to think about that that can lead to trouble, though, is to suppose that, so let's just stick with your example, love, that there's this thing or reality, love, and we share in it, and also God shares in it. That's not the right way to think about it, because then it makes it sound like there's something that's prior to God, and God is, you know, luckily for him, he's able to share in it. That turns God into basically just a creature. So a better way of thinking about it, so the thing I just said that described and then said, no, that's not going to work. Aquinas calls that the analogy of many to one. So you have a bunch of things and then they're all related to some other thing. But Aquinas distinguishes that from another kind of analogy, which he calls the analogy of one to another. So one of the analogous items is the primary one, and the other one is the secondary one. So in this, so all features, all qualities, all realities have their primary mode in God. Whatever exists, it exists in its fullest and most primary way in God. And then what we have is always secondary, imitative, you know, limited. I mean, you could call it a cheap knockoff if you want, but I mean, we should be grateful. Right. It's not a bad thing, but, ours are imitations of God. It's not like ours and God's are imitations of something in itself, but with that proviso, yeah, there's a kind of commonality of content.
Yeah, that's helpful. So one other thing I wanted to make sure to touch on, towards the end of your book, you talk about, does God have real relations with the world? And then you sort of walk through like, is this actually a helpful way of talking? And I love that little section. As brief as it was very, very helpful. So I'd love to hear you just sort of give a brief summary.
So I'm trying to remember, remind me what I said. Is this where I think I do remember what I said. So make sure I'm answering your question right.
Yeah, yeah.
Like in a sort of technical and metaphysical sense, this is related to the stuff we were talking about before, right?
Right.
How all the relations are on. So like the relation of being, when we say God is Lord, Aquinas says what that means is that the creature is subject to God. And so being subject, that's like a relational feature that's present in the creature. But God is just unchanging and simple all the time. Okay. Now, so that sounds like good as a metaphysical doctrine. And if you're in the right mode, it's fine. But if you just go up to a random person and say, God is not related to the world, they are inevitably going to interpret that as meaning something like God doesn't know about you and he doesn't care about you. And that's not the case.
That's right.
And so this is the part. Yeah. So it's very important to remember that, you know, not every way of putting things is helpful for every person. And sometimes you can give somebody some kind of hard, cold metaphysical truth, but do it in the wrong way. And it takes away from them a lot more than it gives. And this is not a helpful way to proceed. And the fact is, if you try full time to think about God only in metaphysical mode, it's just sort of too much for human nature. And Aquinas, in fact, says, you know, because we are not just rational, but rational animals, we rely on our senses and our imagination. What do you know? The Bible is chock full of metaphorical ways of talking about God. So, like, does God have an arm? Of course not, right? God's immaterial. He's a spirit. But, like, the Bible talks about God's holy arm all the time, and that's fine. So I think there's a funny kind of back and forth inevitably that goes on in one's thinking and in one's religious life. You sometimes need to use hard metaphysical and theological thinking to purify your concepts, because otherwise you start thinking that God is just like, just a guy. He's just like a guy like yourself. And that's not okay. But on the other hand, if you go too far, he starts to seem so far away that you can't relate to him anymore. And then you have to just remember that the way the Bible often talks about God is in ways that we can sort of imagine. Mm-hmm. And I should add, I mean, from a specifically Christian point of view, and I do think this is important. Jesus Christ is God, and he is human. So if we say, like, you know, there's like a puzzle. What does it mean to say that God the Father loves us when God the Father doesn't have feelings? And so, like, what kind of love is it that doesn't involve feelings because God is a pure spirit, right? You can get yourself really confused about that question. Now, I mean, I think you can get yourself unconfused, but it's not easy. And if you want to just go ahead and talk metaphorically, that's fine. But I just want to point out that non-metaphorically, Jesus Christ is a human being, and he, like, literally has literal feelings. He, like, literally has a literal heart. So to put this really bluntly, Jesus could literally give you a hug because he's got arms. So I think it's a nice thing to remember for Christians that actually there is a divine person who actually is human. Now, he's not human just like us, but he's still legitimately human. I do think that makes a difference.
Yeah, no, that's really good and helpful. So for those who want to buy this book, I'll remind you, you're listening, you know, there's a link in the show description. So if you're listening on your phone, which I assume you are, you just click on a little thing and there's a link to it. But Michael, are you writing any other books currently that we should be aware of?
Well, I've started working on another metaphysics book that's not so aimed at an introductory level. That's going to be a few years. It's not going to come out anytime soon. I mean, I'll be happy if it's out in 3 years and it could take longer.
That seems reasonable. Hey friend, quick pause of the episode. Want to let you know about three quick things. Number one, our Slack community. If you didn't know this existed, go check it out. You can find more information on our website. It's a place, an opportunity to hang out, to learn, to engage, to be challenged and to be encouraged. So find out more about it at our website. If you want to join, let us know there as well. Number two, if you've ever wanted to support the London Lyceum and the work there, but you didn't feel like you had the financial means, the expendable income to do it, here's another way you can do it. We have an organization, a small business, who is dedicated to supporting the work of the London Lyceum. It's called Professor Lending. So if you're buying a house or in need of refinancing house or something in between, you should check them out. Go to professorlending.com. Right now, they're licensed in both North Carolina and in Florida, but they're looking at adding other states as well. I would know because I'm the owner and leader of that organization. So do check us out there, doing a lot of cool work there, and it's supporting nonprofit institutions like the London Lyceum. And third, we have an October surprise coming up. We'll have more details on this, but I'll give you a little bit of a hint now. It includes John Gill, and it includes several speakers. So you'll find out more information on this soon. We're keeping it under wraps for now, but that will be out very, very soon. So now back to the episode. Enjoy what is probably a dynamite episode and listening experience. Is the best place to find all of your work on your faculty page, or do you have a website or anything?
Well, yeah, my faculty page at the university has links to like a list of my publications. I think somewhere on there you can. So a lot of academics have a page on a website called academia.edu, and a lot of us put up sort of unofficial copies of our published articles on there. There's a legal way to do this. So sometimes if you want to read people's articles, you know, you can usually buy a book, but articles are harder to get at if you're not part of the you know, if you don't have an access to a university library. But often people have, you know, preprints, they're called. Like the pagination is all wrong and stuff. But you can get the content of the articles from people's academia page. And I think I have a link to mine on there.
Okay. Perfect. Well, I really appreciate you doing this. This was a lot of fun. And I do I recommend your book highly. So I think it's a very, very valuable introduction to not just Thomistic metaphysics, but metaphysics in general. And I know we've got a lot of listeners who are interested in these sort of things. So I encourage you to go pick up a copy and read it and share it and talk with other people about it, because it's important and useful and interesting stuff. So, Michael, thanks again for this.
Thanks so much.
And everybody's been listening. Thanks for tuning in and listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.